Do you know where that is? We each wanted the experience of hiking alone, so he's hiking south and I'm hiking north, and we're meeting in the middle. And then we'll go the rest of the summer together. Frank nodded and took another sip from the flask.
Well, then he's crazier than you, he said, after thinking about it for a while. It's one thing to be a woman crazy enough to do what you're doing, another thing to be a man letting his own wife go off and do this.
Yeah, I said, as if I agreed with him. So anyway, we'll be reunited in a few days. I said it with such conviction that I felt convinced of it myself, that Paul that very minute was making his way toward me, that in fact we hadn't filed for divorce 2 months before on a snowy day in April, that he was coming for me, or that he would know if I didn't make it any further down the trail, that my disappearance would be noted in a matter of days. But the opposite was true. The people in my life were like the band-aids that had blown away in the desert wind that first day on the trail. They scattered, and then they were gone. No one expected me to even so much as call when I reached my first stop, or the second or third. Frank leaned back against his seat and adjusted his big metal belt buckle.
There's something else I like to reward myself with after a hard day's work, he said.
What's that? I asked, with a tentative smile, my heart hammering in my chest. My hands on my lap felt tingly. I was acutely aware of my backpack too far away in the bed of the truck. In a flash, I'd decided I'd leave it behind if I had to push the truck door open and run. Frank reached under the seat, where the gun resided in its little black case. He came up with a clear plastic bag. Inside, there were long, thin ropes of red licorice, each bunch wound like a lasso. He held the bag out to me and asked,
"You want some, Miss Jane?"
Chapter 6. A Bull in Both Directions. I devoured a good 6 feet of Frank's red licorice as he drove, and I'd have eaten a good 6 feet more if it had been available.
"You wait here," he told me, once we pulled up in the little dirt driveway that ran alongside his house,
a trailer in the small encampment of trailers in the desert brush.
"I'll go in and tell Annette who you are."
A few minutes later, they emerged together. Annette was plump and gray-haired, the expression on her face unwelcoming and suspicious.
"Is that all you got?"
she grouched as Frank pulled my pack from his truck. I followed them inside, where Frank immediately disappeared into the bathroom.
"Make yourself at home," said Annette,
which I took to mean that I should sit at the dining table that bordered the kitchen while she made me a plate of food. A small blaring television sat on the far corner of the table, the volume so loud it was almost hard to hear. Another story about the O.J. Simpson trial. I watched it until Annette came and set the plate down before me, then turned off the TV.
"It's all you hear about, O.J. this and O.J. that," she said. "You wouldn't think there were children starving in Africa." "You go on and start," she said, gesturing to my food.
"I'll wait," I said in a casual tone that belied the desperation I felt. I gazed down at my plate. It was piled high with barbecued ribs, canned corn, and potato salad. I thought to rise and wash my hands, but I feared doing so might delay dinner. It didn't matter. The notion of whether it was necessary to wash one's hands before eating was now as distant to me as the news report on the TV.
"Eat," Annette commanded, setting a plastic cup of cherry Kool-Aid before me.
I lifted a forkful of potato salad to my mouth. It was so good, I almost fell out of my chair.
"You a college girl?"
"Yes," I said, oddly flattered that I appeared that way to her in spite of my filth and stench. "Or I used to be. I graduated 4 years ago," I said, and then took another bite of food, realizing it was technically a lie. Though I'd promised my mother in the last days of her life that I would finish my BA, I hadn't. My mother had died on the Monday of our spring break, and I'd returned to school the following Monday. I'd staggered my way through a full load of classes that last quarter, half blind with grief, but I did not receive my degree because I'd failed to do one thing. I had not written a 5-page paper for an intermediate-level English class. It should have been a breeze, but when I tried to start writing, I could only stare at my blank computer screen. I walked across the stage in a cap and gown and accepted the little document baton that was handed to me. But when I unrolled it, it said what I knew it would, that until I finished that paper, I would not have my bachelor's degree. I had only my college loans, which, by my calculations, I'd be paying off until I was 43. The next morning, Frank left me at a convenience store on the highway after instructing me to catch a ride to a town called Ridgecrest. I sat on the front porch of the store until a guy who distributed chips came along and said yes when I asked him for a ride, in spite of the fact that it was against company rules to pick up a hitchhiker. His name was Troy, he told me, once I'd climbed into his big truck. He drove around Southern California 5 days a week, delivering bags of chips of all varieties. He'd been married to his high school sweetheart for 17 years, since he was 17.
17 years out of the cage and 17 years in, he joked, though his voice was raw with regret. I'd do anything to trade places with you, he said as we drove. I'm a free spirit who never had the balls to be free.
He left me at Todd's outdoor supply store, where Mr. Todd himself dismantled my stove, cleaned it, installed a new filter, sold me the correct gas, and then led me through a stove lighting trial run just to be sure. I bought more duct tape and second skin for my wounded flesh, and went to a restaurant and ordered a chocolate malt and a cheeseburger with fries, feeling as I had at dinner the evening before, shattered by each delicious bite. Afterwards, I walked through town as cars whizzed by, the faces of the drivers and passengers turning to look at me with cold curiosity. I passed fast food joints and car dealerships, unsure of whether I should stick out my thumb for a ride or spend a night in Ridgecrest and head back to the PCT the next day. As I stood near an intersection, trying to figure out which direction to go, a scruffy-looking man rode up beside me on a bicycle. He held a wrinkled paper bag.
You heading out of town? He asked.
Maybe, I said.
His bike was too small for him, made for a boy instead of a man, with garish flames painted along the sides. Which direction you headed? He asked.
His body odor was so strong I almost coughed, though I guessed I smelled almost as bad as he did. In spite of the bath I'd taken the night before at Frank and Annette's after dinner, I was still dressed in my dirty clothes.
I might stay in a motel for the night, I told him.
Don't do that, he bellowed. I did that and they put me in jail.
I nodded, realizing that he thought that I was like him, a drifter, an outlaw, not a so-called college girl or even a former one. I didn't even try to explain about the PCT.
You can have this, he said, holding the paper bag out to me. It's bread and bologna. You can make sandwiches.
No, thanks, I said, both repulsed and touched by his offer.
Where you from? He asked, reluctant to ride away.
Minnesota.
Hey, he cried, a smile spreading across his grubby face. You're my sister. I'm from Illinois. Illinois and Minnesota are like neighbors.
Well, almost neighbors. There's Wisconsin in between, I said, and instantly regretted it, not wanting to hurt his feelings.
But that's still neighbors, he said,
and held his open palm down low so I would give him 5.
I gave him 5.
Good luck, I said to him as he pedaled away. I walked to a grocery store and wandered up and down the aisles before touching anything, dazzled by the mountains of food. I bought a few things to replace the food I'd eaten when I hadn't been able to make my dehydrated dinners, and walked along a busy throughway until I found what looked like the cheapest motel in town.
My name's Bud,
the man behind the counter said when I asked for a room. He had a hangdog expression and a smoker's cough. Tan jowls hung off the sides of his wrinkled face. When I told him about hiking the PCT, he insisted on washing my clothes.
I can just throw them in with the sheets and towels, darling. It ain't nothing at all, he said when I protested.
I went to my room, stripped, and put on my rain pants and raincoat, though it was a hot June day. Then I walked back to the office and handed my little pile of dirty clothes shyly over to Bud, thanking him again.
"It's 'cause I like your bracelet. That's why I offered," said Bud.
I pulled up the sleeve of my raincoat and we looked at it. It was a faded silver cuff, a POW MIA bracelet my friend Amy had clamped onto my wrist as we said goodbye on a street in Minneapolis weeks before.
"Let me see who you got there."
He reached across the counter and took my wrist and turned it so he could read the words.
"William J. Crockett," he said, and let go.
Amy had done some research and told me who William J. Crockett was, an Air Force pilot who'd been 2 months shy of his 26th birthday when his plane was shot down in Vietnam. She'd worn the bracelet for years without ever taking it off. Since the moment she'd given it to me, neither had I.
"I'm a Vietnam vet myself, so I keep my eyes out for that sort of thing. That's also why I gave you the only room we got that has a tub," said Bud. "I was there in 63, when I was barely 18. But now I'm against war. All kinds of war. 100% against it, except in certain cases."
There was a cigarette burning in a plastic ashtray nearby that Bud picked up but didn't bring to his lips.
"So I'm gonna assume you know there's a lot of snow up there on the Sierra Nevada this year."
"Snow?" I asked.
"It's been a record year. Entirely socked in. There's a BLM office here in town if you want to call them and ask about conditions," he said, and took a drag. "I'll have your clothes ready in an hour or two."
I returned to my room and took a shower and then a bath. Afterwards, I pulled back the bedspread and lay on the bedsheets. My room didn't have an air conditioner, but I felt cool anyway. I felt better than I'd ever felt in all of my life now that the trail had taught me how horrible I could feel. I got up, rummaged through my pack, then reclined on the bed and read As I Lay Dying, while Bud's words about the snow thrummed through me. I knew snow. I had grown up in Minnesota, after all. I'd shoveled it, driven in it, and balled it up in my hands to throw. I'd watched it through windows for days as it fell into piles that stayed frozen for months on the ground. But this snow was different. It was snow that covered the Sierra Nevada so indomitably that the mountains had been named for it. In Spanish, Sierra Nevada means the snowy range. It seemed absurd to me that I'd been hiking in that snowy range all along, that the arid mountains I'd traversed since the moment I set foot on the PCT were technically part of the Sierra Nevada. But they weren't the high Sierras. The formidable range of granite peaks and cliffs beyond Kennedy Meadows that mountaineer and writer John Muir had famously explored and adored more than 100 years before. I hadn't read Muir's books about the Sierra Nevada before I hiked the PCT, but I knew he was the founder of the Sierra Club. Saving the Sierra Nevada from sheep herders, mining operations, tourist development, and other encroachments of the modern age had been his lifelong passion. It's thanks to him and those who supported his cause that most of the Sierra Nevada is still wilderness today. Wilderness that was now apparently snowbound. I wasn't entirely taken by surprise. The authors of my guidebook had warned me about the snow I might encounter in the High Sierras, and I'd come prepared. Or at least, the version of prepared I'd believed was sufficient before I began hiking the PCT. I'd purchased an ice axe and mailed it to myself in the box I would collect at Kennedy Meadows. It had been my assumption when I purchased the ice axe that I'd need it only occasionally for the highest stretches of trail. The guidebook assured me that in a regular year, most of the snow would be melted by the time I hiked the High Sierras in late June and July. It hadn't occurred to me to investigate whether this had been a regular year. I found a phone book in the bedside table and paged through it, then dialed the number for the local office of the Bureau of Land Management.
"Oh, yes, there's lots of snow up there," said the woman who answered. She didn't know the specifics, she told me, but she knew for certain it had been a record year for snowfall in the Sierras.
When I told her I was hiking the PCT, she offered to give me a ride to the trail. I hung up the phone feeling more relieved that I didn't have to hitchhike than worried about the snow. It simply seemed so far away, so impossible. The kind woman from the BLM brought me back to the trail at a place called Walker Pass the next afternoon. As I watched her drive away, I felt both chastened and slightly more confident than I had 9 days before when I'd begun my hike. In the previous days, I'd been charged by a Texas Longhorn bull, torn and bruised by falls and mishaps, and had navigated my way down a remote road past a mountain that was soon to be blown up. I'd made it through miles of desert, ascended and descended countless mountains, and gone days without seeing another person. I'd worn my feet raw, chafed my body until it bled, and carried not only myself over miles of rugged wilderness, but also a pack that weighed more than half of what I did. And I'd done it alone. That was worth something, right? I thought as I walked through the rustic campground near Walker Pass and found a place to camp. It was late, but still light, June in the last week of spring. I pitched my tent and cooked my first hot meal on the trail on my newly functioning stove, dried beans and rice, and watched the sky's light fade in a brilliant show of colors over the mountains, feeling like the luckiest person alive. It was 52 miles to Kennedy Meadows, 16 to my first water on the trail. In the morning, I loaded my pack with another full supply of water and crossed Highway 178. The next road that crossed the Sierra Nevada was 150 as the crow flies miles north, near Tuolumne Meadows. I followed the PCT along its rocky ascendant course in the hot morning sun, catching views of the mountains in all directions, distant and close. The Scotties to the near south, the El Paso Mountains far off to the east, the Domeland Wilderness to the northwest, which I'd reach in a few days. They all looked the same to me, though each was subtly different. I'd become used to having mountains constantly in sight. My vision had changed over the past week. I'd adjusted to the endless miles-long panoramas, become familiar with the perception that I was walking on the land in the very place where it met the sky, the crest. But mostly, I didn't look up. Step by step, my eyes were on the sandy and pebbly trail, my feet sometimes slipping beneath me as I climbed up and switched back. My pack squeaked annoyingly with each step, the sound still emanating from that spot only a few inches from my ear. As I hiked, I tried to force myself not to think about the things that hurt, my shoulders and upper back, my feet and hips. But I succeeded for only short bursts of time. As I traversed the eastern flank of Mount Jenkins, I paused several times to take in vast views of the desert that spread east below me to the vanishing point. By afternoon, I had come to a rock slide and stopped. I looked up the mountain and followed the slide with my eyes all the way down. There was a great river of angular fist-sized metamorphic rocks in place of the once flat 2-foot-wide trail that any human could walk through. And I wasn't even a normal human. I was a human with a god-awful load on my back and without even a trekking pole to balance myself. Why I had neglected to bring a trekking pole while not failing to bring a foldable saw, I did not know. Finding a stick was impossible. The sparse, low, and scraggly trees around me were of no use. There was nothing to do but to push on. My legs trembled as I stepped onto the rock slide in a half squat, fearful that my usual hunching in a remotely upright position would upset the rocks and cause them to slide en masse farther down the mountain, carrying me with them. I fell once, landing hard on my knee, and then I rose to pick my way even more tediously across, the water in the giant dromedary bag on my back sloshing with each step. When I reached the other side of the slide, I was so relieved it didn't matter that my knee was pulsing in pain and bleeding. That's behind me, I thought with gratitude. But I was mistaken. I had to cross 3 more rock slides that afternoon. I camped that night on a high saddle between Mount Jenkins and Mount Owens, my body traumatized by what it had taken to get there, though I'd covered only 8.5 miles. I had silently lambasted myself for not hiking more quickly. But now, as I sat in my camp chair, catatonically spooning my dinner into my mouth from the hot pot that sat in the dirt between my feet, I was only thankful that I'd made it this far. I was at an elevation of 7,000 feet, the sky everywhere around me. To the west, I could see the sun fading over the undulating land in a display of 10 shades of orange and pink. To the east, the seemingly endless desert valley stretched out of sight. The Sierra Nevada is a single up-tilted block of the Earth's crust. Its western slope comprises 90% of the range, the peaks gradually descending to the fertile valleys that eventually give way to the California coast, which parallels the PCT roughly 200 miles to the west for most of the way. The eastern slope of the Sierra Nevada is entirely different, a sharp escarpment that drops abruptly down to a great flat plain of desert that runs all the way to the Great Basin in Nevada. I'd seen the Sierra Nevada only once before, when I'd come west with Paul a few months after we left New York. We'd camped in Death Valley, and the next day drove for hours across a landscape so desolate it seemed not of this earth. By midday, the Sierra Nevada appeared on the western horizon, a great, white, impenetrable wall rising from the land. It was nearly impossible for me to conjure that image now as I sat on the high mountain saddle. I wasn't standing back from that wall anymore. I was on its spine. I stared out over the land in a demolished rapture, too tired to even rise and walk to my tent, watching the sky darken. Above me, the moon rose bright, and below me, far in the distance, the lights in the towns of Inyokern and Ridgecrest twinkled on. The silence was tremendous. The absence felt like a weight. This is what I came for, I thought. This is what I got. When at last I stood and readied my camp for bed, I realized that for the first time on the trail, I hadn't put on my fleece anorak as the sun went down. I hadn't even put on a long-sleeved shirt. There wasn't the slightest chill in the air, even 7,000 feet up. That night, I was grateful for the soft, warm air on my bare arms. But by 10 the next morning, my gratitude was gone. It was seared off of me by the relentless, magnificent heat. By noon, the heat was so merciless and the trail so exposed to the sun, I wondered honestly if I would survive. It was so hot, the only way I could keep going was by stopping every 10 minutes to rest for 5, when I would chug water from my bottle that was hot as tea. As I hiked, I moaned again and again as if that would provide some cooling relief, but nothing changed. The sun still stared ruthlessly down on me, not caring one iota whether I lived or died. The parched scrub and scraggly trees still stood indifferently resolute, as they always had and always would. I was a pebble. I was a leaf. I was the jagged branch of a tree. I was nothing to them. And they were everything to me. I rested in what shade I could find, fantasizing in intricate detail about cold water. The heat was so intense that my memory of it is not so much a sensation as a sound, a whine that rose to a dissonant keen with my head at its very center. Despite the things I'd endured so far on the trail, I'd never once considered quitting. But now, only 10 days out, I was done. I wanted off. I staggered north toward Kennedy Meadows, furious with myself for having come up with this inane idea. Elsewhere, people were having barbecues and days of ease, lounging by lakes and taking naps. They had access to ice cubes and lemonade and rooms whose temperature was 70 degrees. I knew those people. I loved those people. I hated them, too, for how far away they were from me, near death on a trail few had ever even heard of. I was going to quit. Quit, 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 I chanted to myself as I moaned and hiked and rested. 10, 5, 10, 5. I was going to get to Kennedy Meadows, retrieve my resupply box, eat every candy bar I'd packed into it, and then hitch a ride to whatever town the driver who picked me up was going to. I would get myself to a bus station and from there go anywhere. Alaska, I decided instantly, because in Alaska there was most definitely ice. As the notion of quitting settled in, I came up with another reason to bolster my belief that this whole PCT hike had been an outlandishly stupid idea. I'd set out to hike the trail so that I could reflect upon my life, to think about everything that had broken me and make myself whole again. But the truth was, at least so far, I was consumed only with my most immediate and physical suffering. Since I'd begun hiking, the struggles of my life had only fluttered occasionally through my mind. Why, oh why, had my good mother died, and how is it I could live and flourish without her? How could my family, once so close and strong, have fallen apart so swiftly and soundly in the wake of her death? What had I done when I'd squandered my marriage with Paul, the solid, sweet husband who'd loved me so steadfastly? Why had I gotten myself in a sad tangle with heroin and Joe and sex with men I hardly knew? These were the questions I'd held like stones all through the winter and spring as I prepared to hike the Pacific Crest Trail. The ones I'd wept over and wailed over, excavated in excruciating detail in my journal. I'd planned to put them all to rest while hiking the PCT. I'd imagined endless meditations upon sunsets or while staring out across pristine mountain lakes. I'd thought I'd weep tears of cathartic sorrow and restorative joy each day of my journey. Instead, I only moaned, and not because my heart ached. It was because my feet did, and my back did, and so did the still open wounds all around my hips. And also during that second week on the trail, when spring was on the very cusp of turning officially to summer, because I was so hot I thought my head would explode. When I wasn't internally grumbling about my physical state, I found my mind playing and replaying scraps of songs and jingles in an eternal nonsensical loop, as if there were a mixtape radio station in my head. Up against the silence, my brain answered back with fragmented lines from tunes I'd heard over the course of my life. Bits from songs I loved, and clear renditions of jingles from commercials that almost drove me mad. I spent hours trying to push ads for Double Mint Gum and Burger King out of my head, an afternoon trying to recall the next line to an Uncle Tupelo song that went, "Falling out the window, tripping on a wrinkle in the rug." An entire day was spent trying to piece together all the words to Lucinda Williams's "Something About What Happens When We Talk." My feet on fire, my flesh rubbed raw, my muscles and joints aching, the finger that had been denuded of its skin when the bull charged me throbbing with a mild infection, my head broiling and abuzz with random bits of music. At the end of the blistering 10th day of my hike, I practically crawled into a shady grove of cottonwoods and willows that my guidebook identified as Spanish Needle Creek. Unlike many of the places my guidebook listed that had falsely promising names that included the word creek, Spanish Needle Creek truly was one, or at least it was good enough for me. A few inches of water shimmered over the rocks on the creek's shaded bed. Immediately, I shed my pack and my boots and my clothes and sat naked in the cool, shallow water, splashing it over my face and head. In my 10 days on the trail, I'd yet to see another human, so I lounged without concern for anyone coming along, dizzy with ecstasy as I laboriously pumped the cold water through my water purifier and guzzled bottle after bottle. When I woke the next morning to the soft sound of Spanish Needle Creek, I dallied in my tent, watching the sky brighten through the mesh ceiling. I ate a granola bar and read my guidebook, bracing myself for the trail ahead. I rose finally and went to the creek and bathed in it one last time, savoring the luxury. It was only 9 in the morning, but it was hot already, and I dreaded leaving the shady patch along the creek. As I soaked in the 4-inch-deep water, I decided I wasn't going to hike to Kennedy Meadows. Even that was too far at the rate I was going. My guidebook listed a road the trail would cross in 12 miles. On it, I'd do what I'd done before, walk down it until I found a ride. Only this time, I wasn't going to come back. As I prepared to depart, I heard a noise to the south. I turned and saw a bearded man wearing a backpack coming up the trail. His trekking pole made a sharp clicking sound against the packed dirt with each step. "Hello," he called out to me with a smile. "You must be Cheryl Strayed." "Yes," I said in a faltering voice, every bit as stunned to see another human being as I was to hear him speak my name. "I saw you on the trail register," he explained when he saw my expression. "I've been following your tracks for days." I'd soon become used to people approaching me in the wilderness with such familiarity. The trail register served as a kind of social newsletter all summer long. "I'm Greg," he said, shaking my hand before he gestured to my pack. "Are you actually carrying that thing?" We sat in the shade talking about where we were going and where we'd been. He was 40, an accountant from Tacoma, Washington, with a straight-laced, methodical accountant's air. He had been on the PCT since early May, having started where the trail begins at the Mexican border, and he planned to hike all the way to Canada. He was the first person I'd met who was doing essentially what I was doing, though he was hiking much farther. He didn't need me to explain what I was doing out here. He understood. As we spoke, I felt both elated to be in his company and flattened by my growing awareness that he was an entirely different breed, as thoroughly prepared as I was not, versed in trail matters I didn't even know existed. He'd been planning his hike for years, gathering information by corresponding with others who'd hiked the PCT in summers before, and attending what he referred to as long trail hiking conferences. He rattled off distances and elevations and talked in great detail about the pros and cons of internal versus external pack frames. He repeatedly mentioned a man I'd never heard of named Ray Jardine, a legendary long-distance hiker, Greg told me in a reverent tone. Jardine was an expert and indisputable guru on all things PCT, especially on how to hike it without carrying a heavy load. He asked me about my water purifier, my daily protein intake, and the brand of the socks I was wearing. He wanted to know how I treated my blisters and how many miles I was averaging a day. Greg was averaging 22. That very morning, he'd hiked the 7 miles I had agonized over the entire previous day. "It's been harder than I thought it would be," I confessed, my heart heavy with the knowledge that I was even more of a big fat idiot than I'd initially reckoned. "It's all I can do to cover 11 or 12, I lied, as if I'd even done that.
"Oh, sure," Greg said, unsurprised. "That's how it was for me at the beginning, too, Cheryl. Don't worry about it. I'd go 14 or 15 miles if I was lucky, and then I'd be beat. And that was with me training ahead of time, taking weekend trips with my pack fully loaded and so on. Being out here is different. It takes your body a couple of weeks to get conditioned enough to do the big miles."
I nodded, feeling enormously consoled, less by his answer than by his very presence. Despite his clear superiority, he was my kin. I wasn't sure if he felt the same way about me. "What have you been doing with your food at night?" I asked meekly, afraid of his answer.
"Usually I sleep with it."
"Me too," I gushed with relief. Before my trip, I'd had notions of diligently hanging my food from trees each night, as every good backpacker is advised to do. So far, I'd been too exhausted to even consider it. Instead, I'd kept my food bag inside my tent with me, the very place one is warned not to put it, using it as a pillow upon which to prop my swollen feet.
"I pull it right into my tent," said Greg,
and a little something inside of me flared to life.
"That's what the backcountry rangers do. They just don't tell anyone about it because they'd catch hell if some bear came along and mauled someone because of it.
I'll be hanging my food in the more touristy parts of the trail, where the bears have become habituated, but until then I wouldn't worry about it.
I nodded confidently, hoping to communicate the false notion that I knew how to correctly hang a food bag from a tree in such a way that would thwart a bear.
But then, of course, we might not even make it up into those areas, said Greg.
We might not make it, I said, blushing with the irrational thought that he'd somehow divined my plan to quit.
Because of the snow.
Right, the snow. I heard there was some snow.
In the heat, I'd forgotten about it entirely. Bud and the woman from the BLM and Mr. Todd and the man who tried to give me the bag of bread and bologna seemed like nothing now but a far-off dream.
The Sierra's completely socked in, Greg said, echoing Bud's words. Lots of hikers have given up entirely because there was a record snowpack this year. It's going to be tough to get through.
Wow, I said, feeling a mix of both terror and relief. Now I'd have both an excuse and the language for quitting. I wanted to hike the PCT, but I couldn't. It was socked in.
In Kennedy Meadows, we're going to have to make a plan, Greg said. I'll be laying over there a few days to regroup, so I'll be there when you arrive and we can figure it out.
Great, I said lightly, not quite willing to tell him that by the time he got to Kennedy Meadows, I would be on a bus to Anchorage.
We'll hit snow just north of there, and then the trail's buried for several hundred miles.
He stood and swung his pack on with ease. His hairy legs were like the poles of a dock on a Minnesota lake.
We picked the wrong year to hike the PCT.
I guess so, I said as I attempted to lift my pack and lace my arms casually through its straps the way Greg had just done, as if by sheer desire to avoid humiliation I'd suddenly sprout muscles twice the strength of the ones I had. But my pack was too heavy, and I still couldn't get it an inch off the ground. He stepped forward to help me lift it on.
That's one heavy pack, he said, as we struggled it onto my back. Much heavier than mine.
It's so good to see you, I said once I had it on, attempting to not seem to be hunching in a remotely upright position because I had to, but rather leaning forward with purpose and intention. I haven't seen anyone on the trail so far. I thought there'd be more hikers.
Not many people hike the PCT, and certainly not this year with the record snow. A lot of people saw that and postponed their trips until next year.
I wonder if that's what we should do, I asked, hoping he'd say he thought that was a great idea, coming back next year.
You're the only solo woman I've met so far out here, and the only one I've seen on the register, too. It's kind of neat,
I replied with a tiny whimper of a smile.
You all ready to go? He asked.
Ready, I said, with more vigor than I had. I followed him up the trail, walking as fast as I could to keep up, matching my steps with the click of his trekking pole. When we reached a set of switchbacks 15 minutes later, I paused to take a sip of water. Greg, I called to him as he continued on.
Nice to meet you.
He stopped and turned.
Only about 30 miles to Kennedy Meadows.
Yeah, I said, giving him a weak nod. He'd be there the next morning. If I continued on, it would take me 3 days.
It'll be cooler up there, Greg said. It's 1,000 feet higher than this.
Good, I replied wanly.
You're doing fine, Cheryl, he said. Don't worry about it too much. You're green, but you're tough, and tough is what matters the most out here. Not just anyone could do what you're doing.
Thanks, I said, so buoyed by his words that my throat constricted with emotion.
I'll see you up in Kennedy Meadows, he said, and began to hike away.
Kennedy Meadows, I called after him with more clarity than I felt.
We'll make a plan about the snow, he said, before disappearing from sight.
I hiked in the heat of that day with a new determination. Inspired by Greg's faith in me, I didn't give quitting another thought. As I hiked, I pondered the ice axe that would be in my resupply box, the ice axe that allegedly belonged to me. It was black and silver and dangerous looking, an approximately 2-foot-long metal dagger with a shorter, sharper dagger that ran crosswise at the end. I bought it, brought it home, and placed it in the box labeled Kennedy Meadows, assuming that by the time I actually reached Kennedy Meadows, I would know how to use it, having by then been inexplicably transformed into an expert mountaineer. By now, I knew better. The trail had humbled me. Without some kind of ice axe training, there wasn't any question that I was far more likely to impale myself with it than I was to use it to prevent myself from sliding off the side of a mountain. On my trailside breaks that day, in the 100-plus degree heat, I flipped through the pages of my guidebook to see if it said anything about how to use an ice axe. It did not. But of hiking over snow-covered ground, it said that both crampons and an ice axe were necessary, as well as a firm grasp of how to use a compass, an informed respect for avalanches, and a lot of mountaineering sense. I slammed the book shut and hiked on through the heat into the Domeland wilderness, heading toward what I hoped would be an ice axe crash course taught by Greg in Kennedy Meadows. I hardly knew him, and yet he had become a beacon for me, my guiding star to the north. If he could do this, I could, I thought furiously. He wasn't tougher than me. No one was, I told myself, without believing it. I made it the mantra of those days, when I paused before yet another series of switchbacks or skidded down knee-jarring slopes, when patches of flesh peeled off my feet along with my socks, when I lay alone and lonely in my tent at night, I asked, often out loud, "Who is tougher than me?" The answer was always the same, and even when I knew absolutely there was no way on this earth it was true, I said it anyway. No one. As I hiked, the terrain slowly shifted from desert to forest. The trees grew taller and more lush, the shallow stream beds more likely to have a seep of water, the meadows dense with wildflowers. There had been flowers in the desert too, but they'd been less abundant, more exotic, preciously and grandiosely festooned. The wildflowers I encountered now were a more common bunch, growing as they did in bright blankets or rimming the shaded edges of the trail. Many of them were familiar to me, being the same species as or close cousins to those that prospered in Minnesota summers. As I passed them, I felt the presence of my mother so acutely that I had the sensation that she was there. Once I even paused to look around for her before I could go on. On the afternoon of the day I met Greg, I saw my first bear on the trail. Though technically, I heard it first, an unmistakably muscular snort that stopped me in my tracks. When I looked up, I saw an animal as big as a refrigerator standing on all fours on the trail 20 feet away from me. The instant our eyes met, the same startled expression swept across both of our faces. "Bear!" I yelped, and reached for my whistle the moment after he turned and ran, his thick rump rippling in the sun as my whistle peeped its murderously loud peep. It took me a few minutes to work up the courage to continue on. In addition to the reality that I now had to walk in the very direction in which the bear had run, my mind was reeling with the fact that he didn't seem to be a black bear. I'd seen lots of black bears before. The woods of northern Minnesota were thick with them. Often I'd startled them in this very manner while walking or running on the gravel road I grew up on. But those black bears were different from the ones I'd just seen. They were black, black as tar, black as planting soil you bought in big bags from the garden store. This bear hadn't been like any of them. Its coat was cinnamon brown, almost blonde in places. I began to walk tentatively, attempting to make myself believe that surely the bear was not a grizzly or a brown bear, the black bear's more predatory ursine cousins. Of course it was not. I knew it could not be. Those bears didn't live in California any longer. They'd all been killed off years ago. And yet, why was the bear I'd seen so very, very indisputably not black? I held my whistle for an hour, preparing to blow it while also singing songs so as not to take the refrigerator-sized whatever sort of bear it was by surprise should I come upon him again. I belted out my old fallback tunes, the ones I'd used when I'd become convinced the week before that a mountain lion was stalking me, singing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star and Country Roads Take Me Home in artificially brave tones, then letting the mixtape radio station in my head take over, so I simply sang fragments of songs I longed to hear. A mulatto, an albino, a mosquito, my libido, yeah. It was because of this very singing that I almost stepped on a rattlesnake, having failed to absorb that the insistent rattling that increased in volume was actually a rattle, and not just any old rattle, but one attached to the tail end of a serpent as thick as my forearm. Ah, I shrieked when my eyes landed on the snake coiled up a few feet away from me. If I'd been able to jump, I would have. I jumped, but my feet didn't leave the trail. Instead, I scrambled away from the snake's small, blunt head, yowling in terror. It was a good 10 minutes before I could work up the courage to step around it in a wide arc, my entire body quaking. The rest of the day was a slow march, my eyes scanning both the ground and the horizon, terrified at every sound, while also chanting to myself, "I am not afraid." Shaken as I was, I couldn't help but feel grateful to glimpse a couple of the animals that shared this place that had begun to feel a tiny bit like mine. I realized that in spite of my hardships, as I approached the end of the first leg of my journey, I'd begun to feel a blooming affection for the PCT. My backpack, heavy as it was, had come to feel like my almost animate companion. No longer was it the absurd Volkswagen Beetle I'd painfully hoisted on in that motel room in Mojave a couple of weeks before. Now my backpack had a name. Monster. I meant it in the nicest possible way. I was amazed that what I needed to survive could be carried on my back, and most surprising of all, that I could carry it, that I could bear the unbearable. These realizations about my physical, material life couldn't help but spill over into the emotional and spiritual realm. That my complicated life could be made so simple was astounding. It had begun to occur to me that perhaps it was okay that I hadn't spent my days on the trail pondering the sorrows of my life. That perhaps, by being forced to focus on my physical suffering, some of my emotional suffering would fade away. By the end of that second week, I realized that since I'd begun my hike, I hadn't shed a single tear. I hiked the final miles to the narrow flat where I made camp the night before I reached Kennedy Meadows, in the familiar agony that had been my constant companion. I was relieved to see that a wide, fallen tree bordered my campsite. It was long dead, its trunk worn gray and smooth, shorn of its bark ages ago. It formed a high, smooth bench where I sat and removed my pack with ease. As soon as I got my pack off, I lay on the tree as if it were a couch, a sweet respite from the ground. The tree was just wide enough that if I lay still, I could rest without rolling off either side. It felt spectacular. I was hot, thirsty, hungry, and tired, but all of those things were nothing in comparison to the burning pain that emanated from the knots in my upper back. I closed my eyes, sighing with relief. A few minutes later, I felt something on my leg. I looked down and saw that I was covered with black ants, an entire army of them, making a conga line from a hole in the tree and swarming my body. I shot off the log, shouting louder than I had when I'd seen the bear and the rattlesnake, batting at the harmless ants, breathless with an unreasonable fear. And not just of the ants, but of everything. Of the fact that I wasn't of this world, even if I insisted I was. I cooked my dinner and retreated into my tent as soon as I could, well before dark, simply so I could be inside, even if inside only meant being surrounded by a thin sheet of nylon. Before I began hiking the PCT, I'd imagined that I'd sleep inside my tent only when it threatened to rain. That most nights I'd lay my sleeping bag on top of my tarp and sleep beneath the stars. But about this, like so much else, I'd been wrong. Each evening, I ached for the shelter of my tent, for the smallest sense that something was shielding me from the entire rest of the world, keeping me safe not from danger, but from vastness itself. I loved the dim, clammy dark of my tent, the cozy familiarity of the way I arranged my few belongings all around me each night. I pulled out as I lay dying, put on my headlamp, and positioned my food bag beneath my calves, while saying a little prayer that the bear I saw earlier in the day, the black bear, I emphasized, wouldn't bust through my tent to steal it from me. When I woke at 11 to the yipping of coyotes, the light from my headlamp had grown dim. The Faulkner novel was still open on my chest. In the morning, I could barely stand up. It wasn't just that morning, day 14. It had been happening for the past week, an ever-increasing array of problems and pains that made it impossible for me to stand or walk like a regular person when I first emerged from my tent. It was as if I were suddenly a very old woman, limping into the day. I'd managed to carry Monster more than 100 miles over rough and sometimes steep terrain by then, but as each new day began, I couldn't even tolerate my own weight, my feet tender and swollen from the previous day's exertions, my knees too stiff to do what a normal gait required of them. I'd finished ambling barefoot around my camp and was packed up and ready to go when two men appeared on the trail from the south. Like Greg, they greeted me by name before I'd even spoken a word. They were Albert and Matt, a father and son team from Georgia, hiking the entire trail. Albert was 52, Matt, 24. Both had been Eagle Scouts, and they looked it. They had a clean-cut sincerity and a military precision that belied their grizzled beards, their dust-caked calves, and the 5-foot stench cloud that surrounded their every move. "Jiminy Cricket," Albert drawled when he saw Monster. "What you got in there, girlio? Looks like everything but the kitchen sink." "Just backpacking things," I said, reddening with shame. Each of their packs was about half the size of mine. "I'm just teasing you," Albert said kindly. We chatted about the scorching trail behind us and the frozen one ahead. As we spoke, I felt just as I had when I'd met Greg. Giddy to be with them, though being with them only underscored how insufficiently I'd prepared for my hike. I could feel their eyes on me, read them as they shifted from one thought to the next, as they registered my preposterous pack and my dubious grasp of the business at hand, while also acknowledging the moxie it had taken to make it this far on my own. Matt was a big lug of a guy, built like a linebacker, his reddish-brown hair curling softly over his ears and glinting golden on his gargantuan legs. He was only a couple of years younger than me, but so shy he struck me as a kid, letting his dad do most of the talking while he stood off to the side. "Pardon my question," asked Albert, "but how many times are you urinating a day in this heat?"
I haven't been keeping track. Should I be?" I asked, feeling exposed yet again for the wilderness fraud that I was. I hope they hadn't been camped near enough to hear me shrieking about the ants the evening before.
"Ideally it's 7, said Albert crisply. "That's the old Boy Scout rule. Though with this heat and the waterless conditions on the trail, combined with the extreme level of exertion, we've been lucky if it's 3.
"Yeah, me too," I said. Though in fact, there'd been one 24-hour period in the midst of the most ferocious heat, that I hadn't gone even once. "I saw a bear south of here," I said to change the subject. "A brown bear, which was a black bear, of course, but it looked brown, in color, I mean, the black bear."
"They're just cinnamon-colored down in these parts," said Albert. "Bleached by the California sun, I suppose." He tapped the brim of his hat. "We'll be seeing you up in Kennedy Meadows, miss. Pleasure to meet you."
"There's another guy up ahead named Greg," I said. "I met him a couple of days ago, and he said he'd still be there." My insides leapt when I spoke Greg's name, for no other reason than he was the only person I knew on the trail.
We've been following him for a good stretch, so it'll be nice to finally meet him, said Albert. There's another couple of fellas behind us. Most likely they'll be along any time, he said, and turned to look down the trail in the direction that we'd come from. Two kids named Doug and Tom, about the same age as y'all. They started not long before you did, a touch south.
I waved Albert and Matt off and sat for a few minutes pondering the existence of Doug and Tom. And then I rose and spent the next several hours hiking harder than ever, with the single-minded goal that they would not catch up to me before I reached Kennedy Meadows. I was dying to meet them, of course, but I wanted to meet them as the woman who'd left them in her dust, instead of the woman they'd overtaken. Like Greg, Albert and Matt had started hiking at the Mexican border and were by now well-seasoned, logging 20-some miles each day. But Doug and Tom were different. Like me, they'd started only recently on the PCT. Not long before you did, Albert had said, and just a touch south. His words replayed themselves in my mind, as if replaying them would wring more meaning and specificity from them, as if by them I could discern how fast or slow I was traveling in comparison to Doug and Tom, as if the answer to that question held the key to my success or failure at this, the hardest thing I'd ever done. I stopped in my tracks when that thought came into my mind, that hiking the PCT was the hardest thing I'd ever done. Immediately, I amended the thought. Watching my mother die and having to live without her, that was the hardest thing I'd ever done. Leaving Paul and destroying our marriage and life as I knew it for the simple and inexplicable reason that I felt I had to, that had been hard as well. But hiking the PCT was hard in a different way, in a way that made the other hardest things the tiniest bit less hard. It was strange but true, and perhaps I'd known it in some way from the very beginning. Perhaps the impulse to purchase the PCT guidebook months before had been a primal grab for a cure, for the thread of my life that had been severed. I could feel it unspooling behind me, the old thread I'd lost, the new one I was spinning, while I hiked that morning, the snowy peaks of the High Sierras coming into occasional view. As I walked, I didn't think of those snowy peaks. Instead, I thought of what I would do once I arrived at the Kennedy Meadows General Store that afternoon, imagining in fantastic detail the things I would purchase to eat and drink, cold lemonade and candy bars and junk food I seldom ate in my regular life. I pictured the moment when I would lay hands on my first resupply box, which felt to me like a monumental milestone, the palpable proof that I'd made it at least that far. Hello, I said to myself in anticipation of what I'd say once I arrived at the store. I'm a PCT hiker here to pick up my box. My name is Cheryl Strayed. Cheryl Strayed. Cheryl Strayed. Cheryl Strayed. Those two words together still rolled somewhat hesitantly off my tongue. Cheryl had been my name forever, but Strayed was a new addition, only officially my name since April, when Paul and I had filed for divorce. Paul and I had taken on each other's last names when we married, and our two names became one long four-syllable name connected by a hyphen. I never liked it. It was too complicated and cumbersome. Seldom did anyone manage to get it right, and even I stumbled over it a good portion of the time. Cheryl hyphen hyphen, an old grumpy man I briefly worked for called me, flummoxed by my actual name, and I couldn't help but see his point. In that uncertain period, when Paul and I had been separated for several months but were not yet sure we wanted to get divorced, we sat down together to scan a set of no-fault, do-it-yourself divorce documents we'd ordered over the phone, as if holding them in our hands would help us decide what to do. As we paged through the documents, we came across a question that asked the name we'd each have after the divorce. The line beneath the question was perfectly blank. On it, to my amazement, we could write anything, be anyone. We laughed about it at the time, making up incongruous new names for ourselves, names of movie stars and cartoon characters and strange combinations of words that weren't rightly names at all. But later, alone in my apartment, that blank line stuck in my heart. There was no question that if I divorced Paul, I'd choose a new name for myself. I couldn't continue to be Cheryl hyphen hyphen, nor could I go back to having the name I had in high school and be the girl I used to be. So in the months that